Notepad out.
Welcome. Today is May 16th, 2 p.m. We're glad to gavel in the Education Conference Committee. And I think we should let the record reflect that both chairs believe we should be holding this in a different venue today. Quite frankly, I think the Capitol lawn would be a quite beautiful spot today. If I don't think it's raining yet, but we're glad.
So moved.
Yeah, I see Senator Weber is making that motion.
I assume, Madam Chair, you probably don't dare take a vote on that right now, right?
True. We will stay in place, but our hearts may be out in the sunshine. So, members, before us today, the Senate has brought forth, looking at the parameters that we looked at were things that are in both the House bill and the Senate bill in some form, and that don't have dollars attached to them. Until we get those joint budget targets, we won't be addressing that. However, we do have some items where both bodies addressed these items, and there was a little bit of difference in how we addressed them. And so what I think might be helpful is if right to the left of your page, if you were to number that first row 1, and the page is R8A2, that's original row number 65, that's your first item there. If you would put a 1 by that item, and then the one underneath it, which is original row number 68, put a 2, and then original row number 143, put a 1. Just want to make sure nobody zipped ahead there. And then, under the row underneath that, original number 182, please place the number 2. The row underneath that, row number 205, please mark that with a 3. The next two, which are rows 256 and 264, please mark each of those with a 4. And then the final row, 293, was the original number. Please mark that with a 5. That might help us as we go forward on our discussion about these items. What the Senate has proposed here are, we'll kind of take them one by one as we've done in the past, so members have ample opportunity to discuss or ask questions. And then we'll be moving each number as a package. So number 1 would be moved as a package, number 2 as a package, number 3 and 4 and 5. So, Mr. Chair, yes, and we'll obviously take a recess to discuss. You can discuss those with your members, but that would be the intent after you've had that ability to do so. So the first motion, members, would be items 1 on your sheet, and I'll have Mr. Arneson briefly describe those and also where they are so you can find the language, the exact language in your side by side.
Madam Chair, the first set of items that you have marked 1 spans 2 articles. The first is in Article 2 on page R8A2. This is the House provision in Section 8 relating to screening students in early elementary grades for dyslexia. And with the Senate proposal here, there's an A53 amendment, and maybe just for the benefit of those who don't have the amendment in front of them, in the House language page 44, lines 22 and 25, after screened, insert, comma, in a locally determined manner, comma.
And so this amendment would be my original amendment would be amended with this amendment as well. We wanted to make sure that we addressed any potential concerns that had been brought up in committee. And this language has not had any opposition.
Okay. And Madam Chair, the second item in that first pair is in Article 3 on page R8 of Article 3. It's Senate Section 4. This is the Senate proposal relating to teacher preparation programs. and instruction in those programs on dyslexia. So both of these provisions deal with dyslexia intervention strategies and or training.
And I believe we have the A57 amendment.
No, Madam.
Oh, that's on the next one. Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Chair Dabney.
Could I just ask Ms. Pera to walk through the House language and the differences between the House and the Senate?
Yes.
Ms. Pera, if you would. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, yes. So we're on page R8. You're saying the House Section 14 versus the Senate Section 4?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, members, the House version of this language is a technical change proposed by Pelsby, moving away from referring to providers as college and universities and changing it to preparation providers. So the House makes only a technical change there on line 110.3.
Well, I don't know then if it's appropriate to ask Mr. Arneson to compare contrast.
Ms. Butler.
Butler, excuse me. Thank you.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, the Senate language has the similar language as the House file about the teacher preparation providers. But then the Senate file goes on to, in paragraph B, amend the language for the type of instruction that teachers of elementary education are supposed to receive in the preparation programs regarding the evidence-based and structured reading instruction programs. And then paragraph C changes the requirements for teacher prep programs for the teachers in elementary ed, early childhood, and special education and reading intervention to include instruction on dyslexia. And if I could note, Madam Chair, members, the effective date for the Senate section actually needs to be changed to clarify that only paragraph C is effective in June 1, 2020, and not the entire section.
Thank you. We'll need an oral amendment for that. Any further discussion on the pairing? Yes.
Representative Sandstead.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe to both of the chairs, would you prefer to just do your walkthrough on these sections first and then take questions or flesh out questions as they come up?
Yeah, I think it would be helpful to take the question, to have the brief walkthrough about what the proposal looks like, and then as we get that from our staff, I think answering those questions, speaking to that, I think is important at that time.
Okay.
And then we'll recess so you can speak with conferees about that.
Okay. I do have a question then.
Ms. Sandstein.
Thank you very much. In the Senate provision that we just looked at, and I'm looking at specifically 63.14, you have evidence-based. Is there anything in statute that defines evidence-based, or what do you mean by that? I know, having gone through my master's program and having it be an evidence-based program, I know what it means in that context, but in the context of this, I think it might be helpful.
So thank you for the question. So, we understand that, I would just give you the most important aspect is that as we've talked about before, the Senate focuses on students and funds what works. And so evidence-based, in my mind, in any other arena, is you have evidence that what you're doing has a specific result. But there is a little bit more historically to that, the difference between scientific-based and evidence-based, and I believe that Ms. Butler has some of that history. And while she's looking that up, also you might recall this was a House offer, and the only thing that we've done differently is to add the, well, we will add the A57 amendment about local control. It was a previous offer. The other thing that you might want to know is that this was a Senator Claussen proposal in the Minnesota Senate. And, again, we are, quite frankly, what we've been doing for the last good number of years has not been working when it comes to early literacy particularly. And what we have been doing regarding students who have dyslexia, we've seen great results in certain types of instruction for all reading, but particularly for about 20% of our students, those who have dyslexia. So if we want to keep getting the same results that we've always had, which is a good number of our students are not reading proficiently, then we know we'll keep doing what we're doing. But as you've noticed in the Senate proposal, we have done a number of pieces of the Senate bill really focus on early literacy, that evidence-based reading, what works, and this is just one of those provisions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just to clarify, I think it would be helpful, is there an absolute that we're measuring this against? Is there like an ERIC database that we are determining what programs are evidence-based or not evidence-based? What's the absolute measurement that everybody in the state can go to and say this program is or isn't an evidence-based program?
And you're speaking to the teacher prep piece of this, I assume.
I'm speaking to the evidence-based, how you have it defined here in your language.
As far as the teacher preparation programs,
yes.
Determining using evidence-based reading practices. Yes, yes. Ms. Butler.
Madam Chair, members, in the 2017 bill, when the position of the dyslexia specialist was required at the department, in 120B.122, under the requirements, the dyslexia specialist has to be highly trained in dyslexia and related disorders, as well as and in using intervention and treatments that are evidence-based, multisensory, direct, explicit, structured, and sequential in the areas of phonics, phonemic awareness, vocabulary, fluency, and comprehension. So we didn't define what evidence-based is, but it's part of the requirements that go along with what the dyslexia specialist training is.
Yes, yes, yes. As we thought, it's evidence-based in ESSA. So that's defined in ESSA.
And then, Madam Chair, would we need or would it be helpful to have a cross-reference at this point in statute to the statute that you just referenced?
And so Ms. Snyder has texted us about that it's based upon not journalistic proven in journals, but looking that it in the Every Student Succeeds Act is looking towards evidence-based, those programs or interventions or preparations that we have evidence that work.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Looking at the language on 63.15 on the Senate side and the totality of paragraph B there, am I right that your intent is to prohibit teacher preparation programs from teaching any literacy approach other than a structured approach, even if those other approaches may be evidence-based? Because as I see it, this dramatically narrows and limits the, freedom of teachers, of instructors in these programs.
Chair Dabney, the language doesn't say that. The language is pretty clear that programs for teachers of elementary education must require instruction in evidence-based reading. That doesn't mean that there is no other type of instruction. So when we require something, we don't usually throw everything else out. We require that the preparation include this particular provision.
It just was getting to your intent. So having that on the record respecting that there may be other evidence-based approaches that would still be available for teacher preparation programs to instruct elementary candidates in is helpful.
Well, I would hope that teacher prep would be using reading instruction that is not evidence-based. So I don't see that this is eliminating anything except perhaps preparation programs that aren't training teachers to teach reading.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that clarification, I don't think it does either. Thank you.
Chair Yukin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question, too, and I understand and I agree that we should also be teaching evidence-based programs. I do worry, however, about striking out the scientifically-based and wondered if you'd entertain when we take a break of having scientifically-based or evidence-based, because if you look at Section 1 in current law, it cites 122A.06, Subdivision 4, which is the definition for scientifically-based. So I worry that they'd be in conflict, that those two sections would be in conflict with each other because you're taking out the scientifically-based on line 63.14, saying that it only should be evidence-based. So I think it would read and give a little more flexibility and local control to our teachers that are teaching reading to have scientifically-based or evidence-based, since the definition for scientifically-based is in the underlying statute on line 63.17, the 122A.06, subdivision 4.
Yeah. So, Madam Chair, just a couple things. One, I believe that's fine to have both of those there. The key is that our teachers in their teacher prep are getting those their reading instruction that they will be very fluent in evidence-based reading and scientifically-based reading. I do not sense that there is a conflict there. I do want to just be clear that ESSA actually uses the language evidence-based reading. So as we look at ESSA, and it talks about evidence-based practices, evidence-based reading, and, of course, these are what we're looking at here is Pelsby approving those teacher prep programs, and so that those teacher prep programs must include evidence-based and structured reading and a structured reading program. And so if you would like to make an oral amendment to retain scientifically based, we'd certainly entertain that. And I would see that as a friendly amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you mean now or later?
No, I think we're going to take all the action after you've had a chance to go over these steps with your conferees.
There was a pregnant pause there.
Thank you.
All right. So I don't see any other questions or comments on original row 65 and 143. So then we will move to the second row on your paper, which is original row 68. That has to do with statewide testing, basically requiring the commissioner to establish a testing period as late as possible so our students get as much instruction as possible before that testing. But I'll have Mr. Arneson, if you want to speak to that and get us on the right page in the side-by-side.
Madam Chair, the provision you're speaking of begins on R10. In Article 2, it's Senate Section 5, and I believe part of what you're proposing includes an A57 amendment, which I don't believe the members have yet.
The A57 amendment is coming your way.
So in summary, Madam Chair, the Senate provision, again, as you said, requires the commissioner to establish a MCA testing period as late as possible. It strikes some obsolete language. And then the last bit on page R14 actually is the same in both bodies, except after some feedback from the agency, Senate's proposing in the A57 amendment to reinstate the stricken language at Senate page 33, line 31. And I should clarify, the paragraph R on the House side is obviously not present in the Senate language.
And Mr. Arneson, just to reiterate, the reinsertion of computer adaptive assessments was at the request of the department.
Yes, Madam Chair. I think both the House and Senate perhaps got a little greedy in the striking there relative to the rest of the House and Senate proposals.
And I believe both this language on both sides was in response to an OLA report as well. Mr. Arneson?
Madam Chair, would you like me to explain the companion provision
yes.
to that? Okay. So the paired provision in the Senate proposal would be, again, in Article 3 on page R30. And this would be the last remaining unadopted provision related to the American Indian teacher training scholarships. And so the Senate in this proposal proposes to adopt on page R30A3 House Section 49.
Madam Chair.
Chair Yuki.
Thank you. I'm getting a little confused because I actually paired up with that on Senate Article 2 Section 5. It's actually House Article 2 Section 9. On R-1042?
R-30. Madam Chair, yeah, the document in front of members is essentially the side-by-side. So the pairs on the side-by-side indicate, you know, items that are paired in the side-by-side bill in front of you. I believe what the Chair is proposing is that the original row number 68 and original row number 182 are proposed by the Senate Chair for adoption as a pair of items. That the Chair is proposing that these items be considered and adopted as a paired.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson. So the motion will be just so when we come back, the reason I had you number your rows mm-hmm. so carefully was so that after you've had a chance to discuss this proposal, you will know what the motion will look like. The motion will be adopting both of the items that we have, the statewide testing and the grants to prepare the Indian teachers. We're taking a Senate provision and a House provision. Yes, and so they're both number two. Are you clear what ones we're looking at here?
Madam Chair, I just must
Chair
not have had enough coffee today. Would you also be taking, because there are two statewide testing provisions, the one the Senate language addresses the earlier MCAs. On the left side of the column, the Article 2, Section 9 addresses the before and above level testing requirements on the MCAs to shorten it up. So are you saying your proposal would be to accept both of those and then also accept both of the ones on the other line number two?
Yeah. So look at the furthest column on your sheet. It calls to adopt. And so we're proposing adopting the Senate language with the A57 amendment. That'd be the first half. And the second half of that would be proposing adopting the House language where you see grants to prepare Indian teachers. And that's House Article 3, Section 49. Does that provide some clarity for you, Chair Yuki?
Yes, ma'am. Yes and no, Madam Chair. So,
what else would you like to know, Chair Yuki?
Because the Senate Section 5 does. Okay, now I'm getting it. So, you don't like shortening up the MCAs with above and below level questions?
We did not address that.
But you did with accepting the Senate language on that article instead of the House?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? All right, we have the next one will be a little easier for you to understand, I believe. That is the third item that you have penciled in, and that is original row number 205, and it's Article 4 on page R1. So if you can make sure you have that language in front of you. This deals with the individualized education program, and Mr. Arneson.
Madam Chair, yes, on Article 4, on beginning on page 1, which would be House Section 2 and Senate Section 1, what the Senate proposes is to adopt a combination of these provisions. And excuse me, I see that I made a typographical error on the offer sheet, so this should read Senate Paragraph B only, not Senate Paragraph A. So Senate Paragraph B only and House Paragraph D only. So the effect of this would be, if members look on page R2, it would be to adopt the Senate provisions on page R2, and it would be a proposal to adopt on page R3 the House language in Paragraph D only.
Is there any discussion, Mr. Chair?
I'm just wondering if Ms. Parra can again walk the committee through the House provisions.
Mr. Chair and members, the House version of this section makes the following changes. In paragraph B, the language that is not on the Senate side on page R2 is where it says that an IEP team, after affirmative approval of the parent, can eliminate the benchmarks or short-term objectives unless the student takes alternative assessments. So that's in the House language, not on the Senate. The House language also, if you go to page R3, has the provision regarding a paraprofessional assigned to work with an individual student with a disability being given time to review the student's IEP or be briefed on the student's needs, as well as being given paid time to a minimum of 8 hours of paid orientation.
Ms. Farrell, before you go on, I just want to be clear. We don't have budget targets yet. These things involve dollars, and you might recall when we talked about the offer before us, we can't adopt things since we don't have a joint target yet. So I want to reassure the House that these things could not or would not show up in a different adoption. But today we're focusing on those things that do not have budget targets.
Madam Chair.
And so Mr. Chair, and so the ones that we are not addressing are because they have the dollars attached. Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, the provision that Ms. Parra just described on page 160.32 through 161.2 has no fiscal cost to the state.
But that is not in our offer. And again, we picked things that both, so let me just kind of reset the table here. The adoption proposal before us has items that were addressed in both bodies, but in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so the adoption before us is looking at those pieces from each body and things that do not contain dollars. So not to say that we won't come back and go through some of these things, I'm sure we will, but today's offer does not include them because it does not, the articles we're mentioning now were not included at all in the Senate language. So again, we're looking at things that were included in both bodies.
So, Madam Chair, the fact that there is no fiscal cost is immaterial at this point.
There were two criteria. Mm-hmm. One is that they are, as you recall, as this is very consistent with what we have done before. You might even note that I did not even include Senate-only provisions because there was no corresponding House provision. We did not do that earlier, and we're maintaining the very same structure now, which is we are looking at those items that have appeared in both bodies. And the second, and there are other items that have appeared in both bodies that have dollars attached, but you don't see those today here either in our proposal because we don't have that joint budget target yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, so let's see, Mr. Arneson,
Madam Chair, the next pair of items are both in Article 6, Facilities Article. The first item appears on page R2. This is the provision relating to the disposal of surplus school computers. And the Senate proposes, as the first half of this pair, to adopt Senate Section 4 on page R2. And the second member in the pair is on page R8 of the same article. And the Senate proposal is to adopt House Section 8 relating to service cooperatives and joint powers agreements.
Is there any discussion on those provisions? And Mr. Arneson, then the last one, members, is the last on your sheet?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Conversations.
Yes.
What provision did we just discuss?
The provision that we just discussed was provision 4, and you have two lines. Original rule number 256 was disposing of surplus computers, and 264 was the House language regarding the joint powers.
Would Ms. Snyder be able to come forward? I know the MDE has looked at the second provision. Would she be able to come forward and give us the department's perspective?
On the joint powers?
Correct.
Oh, absolutely. Ms. Snyder. And you'll note that the provision we're adopting is the House provision. Ms. Snyder, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Caitlin Snyder with the Minnesota Department of Education. I know that there were some conversations that the department was having related to the potential Senate position on joint powers, and I would like to have Dr. Melger speak to.
So, Ms. Snyder,
Madam Chair, you're recommending the House provision, not the Senate provision.
Correct.
Okay.
My bad.
Okay.
And my apologies.
Oh. Okay, you have been excused.
I appreciate the support for the House position.
We're glad you had him teed up.
My apologies.
So, yes.
Before we go down a rabbit hole on a beautiful spring day.
I know. I just didn't want to. Exactly. So, any further questions?
Okay.
So, we listened intently to those concerns, and we have ceded to the House position on that. All right. And then, so this is the Senate proposal before us. I want to make sure that members have, that we have discussed the amendments that come with them. And I do not believe, we need to get to the
last item.
A51 amendment.
Madam Chair.
And Ms., if you could speak to that.
Yep. Madam Chair, the last row on the item list here is, again, a provision that was in both the House and Senate relating to the creation of an early learning scholarship account in the special revenue fund. And what the Senate is proposing here is to adopt House, on page R10 of Article 8, adopt House Section 10 as amended by the A51 amendment.
So I want to make sure members all have a chance to get to that. And this is following the advice of MMB. And that is with the A51 amendment. And if we need some discussion on that, I think, Ms. Hoffer, you can talk a little bit about our discussion with MMB and why we have the A51 amendment, which is taking a little bit of language out of each House and Senate proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Following some questions from the conference committee here about the differences between the House and the Senate provisions relating to the early learning scholarship account, we did discuss with MMB whether or not the language was necessary in either the House or the Senate provisions. So the language we were discussing specifically in the House was on line 237.28, money in the account is available until spent. As members may be aware, the special revenue fund is a bit different from the general fund in that it's governed by different statutes. And so money that's deposited into the special revenue fund tends to be available until spent unless discussions are had with the agency about funds remaining unspent and the need to spend those down. MMB does have the authority to cancel any funds that are left unspent for a prolonged period of time if the agency is unable to spend those down. As a result, the House language money in the account is available until spent is unnecessary. And then on the Senate language, there was discussion about, it would be lines 122.31 through 123.2. Any funds remaining unspent at the close of the fiscal year 4 years after the initial transfer from the general fund canceled to the general fund. So there was just some discussion about this. Because most funds in the general, in the special revenue fund do have the ability to remain in perpetuity until they're spent down, this would be a choice for the Senate to make those funds cancel back to the general fund at a certain point. There was some discussion while the bill was still in the Senate Finance Committee about whether or not that better complied with the budget rules, and I believe that the finance chair felt that it was necessary to have those sort of guards on the funds because it was a very large appropriation, but given that it's in the special revenue fund, the cancellation language isn't necessary. And so as a result, the Senate recommended adopting the House language, which was Section 10, with the amendment to delete money in the account is available until spent. And then on line 237.30, the A51 amendment would change available to appropriated, which is just a technical change that better conforms with how admin appropriations are usually described.
Thank you. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am supportive of the amendment, and I just want to thank the staff and just note their professionalism and hard work in both the Senate and the House. This is a small point, but I know it took a little bit of, I suspect anyway, it took a little bit of work in pulling it together, and I'm grateful to them. Thank you. And to you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Any further comments or questions? So the Senate will be in a recess for the House to consider this proposal. And Chair Dowdy, how much time do you think you need?
Hopefully, certainly no more than 45 minutes, 30 maybe even.
All right. So we will adjourn until the call of the we will recess until the call of the chair. And we believe we'll give everyone a little bit of grace here, and we'll say it'll probably be close to 3:30. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we are welcome back to the Education Conference Committee. We are ready to move adoption of the articles that we spoke of earlier this afternoon. Let's make sure we have enough of our members in place. Yes, yes. All right. With that, members, I would move that we adopt House Article 2, Section 8, as amended by the A53 amendment, and Senate Article 3, Section 4.
Madam
Chair Youakim.
Madam Chair, thank you. I was wondering on R8, Article 3, page 8. Let's get to the right thing here. On lines 63.14, if you would accept that oral amendment to have reinstate the scientifically based language and have or evidence based. As you said, you might accept that as a friendly amendment.
Chair Youakim, yes, actually scientific based is even a higher standard. And so we will accept that as an amendment, a friendly amendment to the proposal before us. Any further discussion? Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to just understand, and I maybe should have asked this when this was before us the other day.
Yeah.
I know that the phrase comprehensive scientifically based reading instruction has a definition in statute, and I'm just wondering what the Senate's goal was in including evidence-based and structured as opposed to balanced, kind of just what the thinking was with that.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Pinto. We had a significant discussion in the Senate regarding that, and a structured reading instruction program is very structured and contains seven, I believe, different elements. I'm wondering if I could ask Ms. Hagedorn, Jan Hagedorn with the Reading Center. I'm so glad you're in the chamber. If you could come up to the table and speak a little bit more to this about the importance of the exact words we have here structured. Ms. Hagedorn, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, a little bit about what you do, and we'd like to hear a little bit about the importance of structured reading instruction and evidence-based reading instruction. Ms. Hagedorn. Well,
thank you for giving me the chance to do this. My name is Jan Hagedorn. I'm the Reading Readiness Director at the Rochester Reading Center. We teach kids that are dyslexic. That's our purpose. And kids that are dyslexic must be taught with structured reading, systematic, structured reading. Balanced literacy does not work for them. The difference is with the structured explicit instruction, students that do not learn intuitively about how the language works are able to learn the language. Let's see, how can I say this? There is a code for how English works. And for kids that are struggling readers, they do not intuitively learn that code. So with explicit structured instruction, they get it step by step, feeding them the information so they can learn it on a very foundational level for phonemic awareness. And then with each step, we build more skills. So that is a real difference between balanced literacy and structured literacy.
Madam
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hagedorn. I understand you to be describing structured programs as being necessary for children struggling with dyslexia. Is there also an advantage to them, or is it always better for all?
I don't know how this works. It absolutely works for all readers. In fact, research shows that if you use the structured literacy program, students that are excelling actually become better spellers, which then makes them better writers. So it's the idea of, rather than having children have to figure it out on their own, we give them the tools so they can take what we know is true for our language code and then grow with it. So we teach phonemes. We teach how to blend those phonemes together. Then we teach them how the structure of the language works for morphemes so they can learn how to manipulate the language and what the meanings are. So it's a very explicit instruction.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like, Ms. Hagedorn, like you're saying that, so it sounds like we're replacing, by replacing the word balance with the word structure, we're sort of choosing a better, there's a better form of reading instruction by having it be structured rather than balanced.
In the research, in the research for reading, there is no question that structured literacy will get more children reading than balanced literacy.
Chair Pinto, and I do want to just remind the conferees, as we spoke of earlier, that this is a requirement. It is not an exclusive requirement. So we do want to make sure that that there's an understanding there, that we're not reading more into this than the language actually states.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. So if I'm understanding you right, I just want to make sure I understand about the requirement that the teacher programs, I guess, have to instruct students in those programs as to how to do structured reading instruction programs, but they could choose to do others as well. Is that what the chair is referencing? I just want to make sure I understand your comment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I believe that this is a requirement that they receive instruction in scientifically based, evidence-based, and a structured reading program. There are other instruction elements as well, but we must, at a very minimum, make sure that every teacher that is prepared in the state of Minnesota, that goes into our classrooms and works with our children, teaching them to read, understands structurally evidence-based reading program. I think it is almost malfeasance if we send teachers out into the classroom who do not have this type of preparation. Doesn't mean there aren't other things that exist, but if we want to change the dynamic, if we want to change the dial on literacy, we must make sure our teachers have this preparation.
And Madam Chair, one final follow-up.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the addition of evidence-based as an option for either that or scientifically-based, or in the original language with evidence-based, what is the benefit, either Ms. Hagedorn or perhaps you, Madam Chair, in that evidence-based as being a possibility rather than scientific-based? Just to understand the distinction between the two.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. We did describe that a little bit earlier in that ESSA talks about evidence-based structure, evidence-based teaching, and scientifically based is actually of a higher standard, which has been peer-reviewed by scientific journals, and we don't necessarily have that as much. But if Ms. Hagedorn has more to add, please go right ahead.
Well,
Ms. Hagedorn.
Yes, thank you for asking. The very gold standard is scientifically based because they're using control models. And in evidence-based models, they often don't have controls, but they can make some assumptions based with good research techniques. So I think the difference between just having research and using evidence-based research is saying that you actually are using some standards of how you apply the information so that you're truly testing it rather than just making a graph to make it look good.
Madam Chair, just make one final
Chair
thing.
Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment that in the way that's described, I think in the Health and Human Services world, I would think of what you're describing as scientifically based as they would use the phrase evidence-based, and then they would use the phrase evidence-informed for what's being referred to evidence-based here. I might be wrong, so somebody afterwards can come up. But I, Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you, Ms. Hagedorn.
And so, Chair Pinto, we have both. We have it all covered here with this oral amendment. Thank you very much. Chair Depp.
Madam Chair, so just to clarify, are you incorporating the UAC Moral Amendment? Or
yes.
Do we need, okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
So any further discussion?
Yes.
Chair Pinto. Well, actually, we've amended the, I think Chair Youakim offered an amendment to the amendment. So the A53 amendment, do we need to vote on that amendment to the amendment?
I think that was my question about whether you're incorporating
we
need a vote.
No, I think we'll just vote on that. So all those in favor of the A53 as amended by Chair Youakim's mm-hmm. oral amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Okay. The amendment has been amended.
Sorry, Madam mm-hmm. Chair. And then our staff on my side, on the House side, has raised questions about paragraph A there. And it's grammatical.
Can you show me paragraph A?
So we're on page 63.1 of the Senate side on R8A3. And there are, I'm told, just grammatical issues. This I think this is a threshold below technical. No. So the question is, would you be comfortable with directing staff as they work on the amended language to simply clean up the grammatical concerns with paragraph A?
We often do that. If you want to mention those right away, we'll make sure that we have sharp pencils to, if you can mention those. But we always do that at the end of our bills, obviously, grammatical changes.
But since this is existing statute that is not being amended, Ms. Pera can help. I'm not the guy to catch the,
sure.
the grammatical errors.
Yeah, a couple examples would help. Ms. Pair.
Madam Chair, members, it's just things like going from singular to plural, and then both chambers strike colleges and universities in one line, but don't do it in another line. So it's those types of things.
Yes, thank you. We did mention that, and yes, we will definitely call on our nonpartisan staff to iron out those mm-hmm. Issues with. I would say grammatical issues, perhaps.
And then, Madam Chair?
Yes.
You had raised, I believe, an issue with the effective date.
Oh, yes.
So just so we attend to that.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Dabney. And what did we need to, I'll call on Ms. Butler to describe exactly where we need to insert the effective date and perhaps remove it from. Ms. Butler.
Madam Chair, members, on R9, if you go to line 64.3 of the Senate language, I would suggest you delete this section and insert paragraph C.
Say that again, Ms. Butler.
Madam Chair, members, on 64.3, delete this section and insert paragraph C.
All right. Okay. Is there any discussion on that? All those in favor of deleting this section and insert paragraph C, which would be at 64.3, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment has been adopted. And now we're back on to the original motion as amended, which is adopting House Article 2, Section 8 as amended with the A53 amendment as amended. And Senate Section 3, excuse me, and Senate Article 3, Section 4. Any? As amended. Thank you. As amended. Any further discussion? All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Okay. Adopted. Members, the next motion is to adopt Senate Article 2, Section 5, with the A57 amendment and House Article 3, Section 49. Just to refresh, members, you all have that A57 amendment in front of you? We discussed that a bit earlier. We had significant discussion on also adopting House Article 3, Section 49. Sir, can everybody see that language? Okay. All those, any questions?
I think Representative Erdahl.
Representative Erdahl.
The 203 amendment?
Well, let's see. We have the 857. Yes. So we just have the A57. We've moved that amendment. Does he want to amend that? So, yeah. So, Representative Erdahl, I think your motion would be to amend the A57 amendment with the A203.
Okay. Just want to make sure
yes.
The process is right here.
Yes.
I will have.
And to your, to the A203, Rep. Erdahl, we didn't speak about that prior, before our recess, so do you want to discuss that briefly?
Sure. As many of you know, I've been kind of crusading on civics education this year. And, you know, I have this portion of it. There are three parts to the bill. One dealing with having credit, the course for credit in civics to juniors or seniors. One dealing with civic life, and the other dealing with aggregate accounting of test scores. And this one deals with the first part, the credit alignment here. So I have tried to address every possible question that comes up with this. Sometimes I felt like it was kind of like whack-a-mole. I would get something figured out, and then something else would come up. And finally, now there were objections to certain things about mandating and whatever. And as a born-again local controller, I decided that we would make this permissive. So all this says is that a school district is encouraged to offer a course for credit in government and citizenship to 11th or 12th graders who begin 9th grade in the 2020-21 school year. As Senator Nelson has said many times, if things aren't working, you have to look at ways that maybe you can make them better. You've talked about moving the needle a little bit. I think this does that. I appreciate Senator Nelson your help on this for over a year now that we've been working on this. Last year it made it into the bill that was vetoed. We have this provision again this year. We are basically accepting Senate language here with a brief one-word amendment encouraged. And I have another amendment that I would like to offer, which puts in the civic life portion, which is in the House bill. So, in other words, we would be trading one position. We would each be taking the position of another. And the third one, the accounting, I think would be left up to discussion between you, Madam Chair, and Chair Dabney. And I have every bit of confidence, Chair Nelson, in your very fine negotiating ability to work this out. So with that, I renew my motion here to do the A03 amendment, which deals with making your language not a mandate but permissive regarding credits for civics.
Madam Chair?
Chair Dabney.
Madam Chair, I first want to thank Representative Erdahl for being a model of persistence when it comes to this this topic. He has done that and more. I think he has made some very good arguments. I know when you accepted the amendment on the floor with the mandate, you expressed some hesitation in that acceptance. And if I recall correctly, it was the possible impact of that mandate of moving civics to 11th or 12th grade on students involved in CTE programs, students involved in PSEO programs, students who are looking to take AP or dual enrollment programs, that shifting this around and making it mandatory at 11th or 12th grade can create problems for those students. And I want to share those concerns, and that's been part of the session-long conversation that Representative Erdahl and I have had. I also know that in my school district, there are certain high schools that really have found that teaching it at ninth grade better sets students up for later history and other social studies courses, that it lays a groundwork where they understand as emerging young adults how we make decisions in our society, and that doing that at ninth grade is positive. I'd want to leave this up for that local control thing. As a Representative Erdahl describes himself as a born-again local control person, I, you know, want to leave this up to that social studies department in that high school to make the determination. And this language does that, and I think responds to some of the concerns that you had on the Senate floor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, you need to tell us where this is in the side-by-side. So we see that as the Senate author, of course, I was the Senate author. You are the House author. We want to see the exact language in the side-by-side, which my staff has found here already, which is Article 2, R15. Article 5? No. Oh, I'm sorry. Can't read upside down.
R15.
Article
A2.
A2, R5. I just want to make sure that we have the language beside us. Yes.
Madam Chair?
We're looking over, so that's the Senate language. We're looking over for the House language, which is in a different spot, which is R15.
R15A2.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Once again, of the three parts of the bill, you wound up with one, we wound up with one, and the third one is floating in Never Never Land. And we are asking here, essentially, that we bring two of them together.
So, Representative Erdahl, this is just a bit premature. This wasn't part of the proposal that the Senate brought, and it also does not, well, number one, I appreciate the language. I think looking at the A203 is good language. I think any time that we can not mandate our schools is the right approach. Encourage is the right approach. We worked very hard in the Senate bill to do encouragement and not mandates. So I appreciate the direction of this. What you need to know is that this amendment is a standalone amendment. It does not construe or obligate any other provisions of the things that, for example, of what you talked about, the other issues. And so those are things that will be addressed at a later time. But the amendment before us, your A203, which has been amended onto the A57 is specifically the language in paragraph D. So it's very clear, and I don't want to have any misunderstanding that by accepting this amendment or as a friendly amendment or my support of it would any way, in any shape, indicate additional support of any other type of language in our side-by-sides. Okay, I just wanted to be clear. So we just had to be very, very clear on that. So members, while we've had a lot of discussion about a number of issues and regarding the civics encouragement and other things in addition to this, I'm cautious, however, about adding a amendment that is a policy that we haven't even addressed yet here today. I guess I'm a little concerned about that.
Madam Chair.
Yeah. So, yeah, I do want to set a precedent here, but Ms. Chair Erdahl, Representative Erdahl.
You can call me chair.
See, I called you senator, too, but we'll go with rep for today.
Madam Chair, you know, this is nothing new. I mean,
we've done it for years.
It's gone through your committee. We've been talking about it for a year. If anybody doesn't know what this is, I'll keep talking and talking and talking.
Chair Gavney and I have addressed that.
I don't know that he needs to
how much do you want to hear from me?
No, we don't want to hear any more than we need to. But what I did want to make clear is that this is a premature piece in that we haven't addressed there's a more full section on civics, but. And I'm sure that we will be addressing that at some point. And it is in both bills. And so and the things that were kind of part of our parameters are, is there language in both bills? And there is. It's addressed in both bills. And the other piece was, while we are waiting for that joint budget target, we're not going to address any money issues. And so a piece that I'm very interested in did have a fiscal note. So we're going to have to hold off on that. But I would encourage members to adopt the A203. I see that as a friendly amendment to the A57. And is there any further discussion? I'm just kind of looking at Rep. Erdahl. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the reasons why we added the definitions of civic life in that section that Representative Erdahl
Chair,
was talking
about. We do not have that. We're not addressing that right now. I just want to keep us focused on what we have, which
Madam
is
Chair,
the A203.
Chair Joachim. Why I'm trying to explain is the conversation that we had that I think you might be interested in because I know you really do care about PSEO. The conversation we had in committee was that was comfort language for PSEO folks when it has the definition of civics life and how that addresses if they're going to be teaching it in 11th and 12th grade as a credit. It gives them flexibility to still be able to do it as a PSEO class. So that might be something Mr. Donham could chat with you about later. That might give you a little bit of comfort, but that was comfort language for PSEO folks.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. I think that was the bill as I originally authored that. But is there any further discussion? So what we have before us, members, we do have, I think we first need to adopt the A203 to the A57. So there's an amendment, the A203, Representative Erdahl, I would like to amend the A57. We've had a long, lengthy discussion on this. Seeing no more questions, hope you're all fully informed and ready to vote. All right, all those in favor of adopting the A203, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Congratulations, Rep. Erdahl. That has been adopted. And now we have the A57 as adopted by the 203. Representative Erdahl.
Now, you did mention the civic life experiential learning. I am prepared to offer that as well today. Would you prefer that it be done at a later time?
Yes, I was very, very clear on that. Thank you for asking.
I wasn't real clear, see, so I just wanted to.
I can be very clear, too. All right, Representative Verdahl, hang on for a better time. Thank you very much. All right, so members, now to what we have in front of us. So I move that we adopt Senate Article 2, Section 5, with the A57 as amended, and House Article 3, Section 49. We've had a good deal of discussion. I want to make sure everyone is fully informed. All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. No, same sign. The provisions have been adopted.
Madam Chair?
Chair Dack.
I believe that that marks the 40th Senate provision that we've adopted in this conference committee.
Oh, Chair, I am so glad we are keeping track. I know we have those House numbers as well,
you know,
and we will add those. Actually,
most, not all, we've adopted several Senate provisions standalone. Most of them were, you know, joint,
yes,
which such as that one, that, you know, just a little tweak. But
so
the Senate has done some good work this year.
So thank you, Chair Dabney. Actually, I think we have done good work. I think if we look back and look at all the things that we have been able to adopt from both of the chamber bills, I believe we've done a very good job under the constraints that we have, which is we just don't have those joint targets yet. So I do commend all the members for their patience as we work through those things that are truly within our jurisdiction right now. Thank you, Chair Dabney. We'll get you that running house number, too.
All right.
All right. So, members, the next item on your sheet was what we had marked as item 3, and that is I would move House Article 4, Section 2, Paragraph D only, and Senate Article 4, Section 1, Paragraph B only. Might recall our discussion on that. And that looks like it's on Article 4R1, just to refresh your memories.
Madam Chair?
Chair Yuking.
Yes, I'd like to make, and I don't have it printed out, but I'd like to make an oral amendment on this.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to the language then so we can insert that in the right spot. Chair Yuking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't say I feel bad that we're giving up the House provision on the short-term objectives. We had a lot of great discussion on this in committee and some very very strong advocates for it, but I'd be willing to do that if you could look at, and I also do respect not wanting to take language that has money. I get that. But if you look at the language on 160.32 to 161.2, and in particular the word or on 160.33, this does not cost money because it says that it requires the parent to be given time during the school day to review a student's individual education plan program. And just to give a little background on the discussion we had around this in committee, and I know we're not talking about the funding stuff today, but one of the reasons why we brought that forward for parent training is that our paraprofessionals, especially in the area of special education, deal with a lot of intense need from students, from kids that have high ACEs scores and paras need trauma training, to crisis prevention and intervention training to keep kids and themselves safe. But also, we deal with a lot of students that are medically fragile. And by medically fragile, I mean students that have feeding tubes, students that have a variety of different accoutrements that come with them that need to be navigated with and dealt with. So you could be a para that's subbing and come in and be given a student that has a feeding tube and needs help with toileting where the feeding tube is close to, and not have any idea because you've not been prepared to deal with that child, but it's your job. Mm-hmm. And we really need parents to have the full gamut of knowing what they're supposed to be dealing with. And it's not just medically fragile. I can explain from an experience that I had working with a student as a para helping him with math, who I had not realized he had been abused by his father. Father was in jail for sexual abuse, and the student I was working with needed help with math, and he always wanted to count my fingers and not use the dots on the paper. I always gave him a choice, but the minute I would put my hands up even a few feet, 3-4 feet from his face, he'd get very anxiety-ridden. Sometimes he'd scream, sometimes he'd cry, and I didn't know what was going on until I finally had a chance to look at his IEP and was given time during a lunch break to look at it, to realize the student, what had happened to the student, and once I got trauma training, which was a whole other month later, to realize I was probably re-stigmatizing this poor child every time we did math. So my point here is there is a variety of needs that our children have that we're dealing with, that it would really be beneficial for that paraprofessional to be able to just have a chance during the school day to look at that IEP. Now, ideally, a para would be trained ahead of the school year. A para would know their caseload. A para would know what kids they're dealing with and be prepared fully for that. In reality, that with our cash-strapped districts and all the issues they're having with the cross-subsidy and trying to find the money to even get through the school day, that's not going to always happen. That's why, you know, when we start talking about money, we'll explain why it's so important to get paras some training. But just to have this language in here that requires that a para is able to look at that IEP during the school day could make a tremendous difference to so many of our students. So this is a portion of this language that does not cost anything that I would beseech you to consider adding.
Well, thank you, Chair Joachim. And I agree with you. I mean, we thank God for our paras. They do a remarkable job, and sometimes under very difficult situations. And they make a world of difference in our classrooms. They make a world of difference with our students, with all of our students, not just the students that they might be working with, but with all of our students. So I definitely understand. And we would hope that all teachers, anyone who interacts with our children, with our students, would have what I would call that necessary background information of an IEP. But with that said, this is not just a local control issue. That would be the state of Minnesota stepping in. It's a management issue. It would be the state of Minnesota stepping in, telling schools how to manage their staff and their staff time. I think there's also another layer, too. I believe all of our paras, I think we have six different unions that represent non-licensed teachers in our schools, one of them for paras, and we have different, I also think there's several different bargaining units as well. But the issue is, this is a locally, first it's a local control issue, but more importantly, it's a negotiated issue. It's a contract issue. It's a locally negotiated contract issue. So there's a couple things so we've had a lot of talk in this, in our conference committee about how the Senate really looks to not mandate things, looks for local control, and definitely I do not want to step into negotiated contract language. So I would be voting no on this, and I would encourage senators to hold the Senate position and oppose this particular amendment, not because the goal is wrong. It's what should happen. It's what we would like to see happen. But I don't believe that we should step into negotiated union contracts. And I don't believe we should step into telling our schools how to manage their staff.
Madam Chair, follow up?
Excuse me. Madam Chair.
Thank you. So I understand that. In fact, I'm glad you brought up the local control issue, because when I worked out this language, this was the compromise language of MSBA, and they are comfortable with the or to do that during the school day. And there's plenty of places in statute where we set a floor of what the bare minimum should be required in dealing with our students. And when we're talking about some of the most medically fragile and some of the most severely needy students in our schools, I think setting this basic floor of making sure a paraprofessional that has to deal with them can look at their IEP is a pretty basic floor we should be setting.
Chair Yukim, definitely understand where you're going with that. I don't believe in stepping into those contract negotiations. And the other, remember the parameters that we're dealing with here, language in both bodies and no dollars. I think there would be dollars attached to this, but I could be wrong on that. But because anytime we ask our school staff to do something or additional time, there are dollars involved. But also, so I could be mistaken on that. I don't know, because we didn't hear it in the Minnesota Senate. So we don't have any provision, any language along this line in the Senate. So it doesn't really fit our parameters of what we have brought to the table here, of what we've been working on so far.
Madam Chair, I understand that, but we've already accepted language of yours we didn't hear in the House. So we just accepted Senate language on the dyslexia training for teachers that we did not hear in the House policy provision.
That was an offer from the conference committee to the Senate. So we'll set that aside. But we you did offer that, yes.
Madam Chair.
Chair Daffy.
Madam Chair, I hope you'll hear the wisdom of Chair Yukim on the appropriate role of the legislature. And I think that's the one piece that she signaled appropriately, is that we set a floor. And we encourage and support our school districts to innovate above that floor. But we know from testimony in the House in the past that we have school districts that don't allow paraprofessionals to read the IEPs of the students that they're responsible for. You talked about hope. I'm reminded of my father, who said, you can wish in one hand and spit in the other and see which fills up first. Hope is good, but it doesn't get the students, which I would say our other responsibility is look out for the best interest of the students. And not allowing a paraprofessional to review the IEP of a medically fragile student, of a student with a history of trauma, of a student with needs special services because they're on the autism spectrum and so on, before dealing with that student, does not look out for the best interest of the student. And I believe that is our responsibility. If I were a parent of one of those students and I found out that the staff taking care of my child was not being allowed to understand how to take care of that child as the school and we as the parents had agreed to through the IEP, I would be outraged. And I would be deeply concerned. I hear the voices of the parents of students with autism who say, you know, if you know one kid with autism or on the autism spectrum, you know one kid on the autism spectrum. And those labels only get you so far in understanding how to best work with that child. The IEP is really the document that needs reviewing to understand how dealing with little Carla with autism and is different than dealing with little Jim with autism. I would certainly urge that you reconsider and accept the Yukim amendment.
Chair Dabney, was there an amendment offered? I didn't recall. Did you offer an amendment?
Oral amendment.
Thank you.
For lines 160.32 to 161.2 in the House language.
Thank you, Chair Yukim. Chair Dabney, there is nothing that is preventing, so don't read more into language that is there, or don't read into, there's nothing that is preventing a paraprofessional from reading a student's IEP. What this language is doing is stepping in where our union contracts determine these type of issues and where management works with our unions to determine these kind of contracts. I'm not saying no forever. I'm saying no today.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Rep. Sandstein.
Thank you very much. I was going to talk, and members, I was going to kind of share from a teacher's perspective. why I think this amendment is an excellent amendment. And if you don't know, I'm a very strong union activist and supporter. This is a very important amendment, and I'm not going to speak to you as a teacher. I am going to speak to you as a parent of two children who have IEPs and how critical it is for the person who is assigned to my children or somebody else's children to have a full understanding of who the student is that they're working with and how best they can serve that individual. And that comes before contracts and labor negotiations. And I can say that school districts, school officials, teachers, paras, are there first and foremost to do the right by all of our students. That's why we are in this business. That is why we come to this profession. When we underfund, when we underinvest in education, we go back to the conversation that districts have to make hard choices. Unfortunately, these hard choices are borne on the backs of our students far too often. This is reasonable. This is common sense. And it is really outrageous that we could sit around this table and say we really can't talk about this today. I have a level of indignant right now as a parent. And I'm offended as an educator. And I'm certainly not sitting here trying to scold you. But this is our job. And these are the real impacts. And it isn't just the medically fragile. It is thousands of students with all types of disabilities or challenges. And we have the expectation as a state to get them across the finish line to the best of their ability, to be successful, to be able to read. How do you help a student when you know nothing about them? How do you walk into a doctor's office with the expectation they're going to treat you if they haven't looked at your chart, your case? They don't even know what this is. That's a parallel to what we're looking at in the world of education. And I mean you no disrespect, but I ask for support of this amendment. This is legitimate.
Any further discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wicker.
Chair Yakim mentioned that her amendment before us had been vetted, and it was represented that the Minnesota School Boards Association agreed with it, and Madam Chair, you've expressed a part of our concern about local control, which most of us share, but we also know about the importance of best serving students, etc. But the representation that the school boards may be supportive would be very important to me, and if they're prepared to just state or to affirm if that statement is their position, that would help me in my vote.
Thank you, Senator Wicker. This is not the time now for this. As you recall, when we came in, we talked about those things that are in both bodies that might have different language, which is what we have done. We would want to hear from the school boards on this particular amendment. At this point, I believe it's a locally bargained, negotiated statement, and I firmly am concerned about stepping into those union contracts, and also these management issues that we're going to start telling our schools what they need and must not do. But I do want to make it very clear, as I said earlier, that we do want our teachers, our paras, everyone that works with
our students, everyone that works with our students, to be able to read those IEPs. And there's and they're not prohibited to. I think there was some discussion about that we would prohibit. There's no prohibition of reading IEPs. The language before us is specifically saying, given a certain amount of time or certain pay to do so, which is clearly a contracting issue. So this is not in our bill. It's clearly outside of the parameters of the offer that we made today. We may have other days, and there will be other offers. But today, this is clearly not part of the Senate offer that we kindly gave to the House at our 2 o'clock meeting and offered them. We discussed the proposal. We discussed what we offered for adoption. We gave the House time to go and address this with their members, which I'm so glad that they were able to do. At this moment now, I am not prepared to support something that is clearly outside of the adoption that we brought on at 2 o'clock today. Okay. But there may be another time.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I appreciate that
Senator
maybe
Weaver.
Procedurally in this frame, it's not set to be teed up, and in that
correct
context, and perhaps in good faith, I rather than see this potentially voted down if Representative Yakim would consider withdrawing the amendment with the understanding that it could very likely be before us again on an offer sheet, and it would give a chance. I really want to have some additional dialogue with School Boards Association. So I offer that to Representative Yakim, but
Madam Chair,
your points were very well made.
Madam Chair?
Chair Dabney.
I'd suggest we just set aside this provision at this time.
We can do so. We will set aside Provision 3. So if you could clarify...
Certainly.
So we have the proposal, the offer was Senate paragraph B and House paragraph D only. If you like, we can adopt those and not address this one at all now. What's your intention? What did you ask to set aside specifically?
The package that you have identified as three, House Article 4, Section 2, and Senate Article 4, Section 1.
So thank you.
And any amendments.
Yep. So, Mr. Chair, those will be set aside. We have always honored that request, and we'll do so today as well. Those have been set aside. Members, the next we have is numbers 4 on your sheet. Those would have been the last... 6th and 7th on your sheet. I would move, members, that we adopt Senate Article 6, Section 4, and House Article 6, Section 8. We discussed those earlier. It has to do with disposing of school computers and then also of taking the House language regarding those joint power agreements and omitting the Senate language, which included charters. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you for this, this is agreeable to the House. I think the addition of districts being able to donate to nonprofits for distribution is a fine thing. I would hope, however, since those computers have been paid for by the taxpayers of Minnesota, that those nonprofits would be Minnesota-based nonprofits who would distribute those to Minnesotans, you know, keeping the taxpayers' money in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very glad you brought that up because this was a Senator Newton amendment. And what they are doing in his school district, actually, though, they are donating these surplus computers to, yes, nonprofits mm-hmm. who have an educational purpose mm-hmm. and mission, but to Haiti. So it's not just to Minnesota. His desire was that they be able to contribute, and the Senate, we adopted that as a friendly amendment. And so those were deemed surplus computers. And again, it was a nonprofit. Let me look at the exact language here. Let me read it for you. It's a charitable organization under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code that is registered with an Attorney General's Office for Educational Use.
You know, and Madam Chair, I can certainly appreciate the needs of Haiti. I would just remind Senator Newton that there are needs here in Minnesota, and that Minnesota taxpayers actually are the ones who paid for it. So I would, yes. I would hope they would consider that in their donation policy and practice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure they will, especially after your discussion. Thank you so much. Any further discussion? All right. Members, then again, I'll restate and renew my motion that we move Senate Article 6, Section 4, and House Article 6, Section 8. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Adopted. We have one other item for adoption today, and that would be the last item on your sheet. This has to do with a special revenue account with our early learning scholarships. I would move that we adopt House Article 8, Section 10, with the A51 amendment. You might recall we had some significant discussion about this. The A51 better adopts both the House language and the Senate language to MMB's suggestions regarding this special revenue account. Any further discussion or comments? I want to make sure everyone has that's the A51. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Adopted. So we are through what we've deemed those things that are in both bodies and without dollars. We're waiting, hoping that we understand that the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader in the Senate and the Governor went back into negotiations at about 3:30 today. And while we will be waiting until we hear from them. So we will be in recess until the call of the chair. Hope springs eternal.
Oh my.
And we are hoping. I am. We could adjourn for the day, but we are still, I am still hopeful that I know they were here until 2:30 this morning. They've been negotiating off and on throughout the day. It is not my intention, however, to bring us back into committee today if we do not have some sort of movement or agreement. But Chair Dabney, you and I and our committees have done a lot of good work already. We have a lot of things that are ready to go. And so I would say to our audience today, stay tuned to your news feeds. And if there's an agreement, we'll be back in session. We will reconvene.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Chair,
one of the practices in the House is to provide a time buffer when we recess to the call of the chair, saying an hour. We will announce the reconvening an hour before reconvening so that people have the opportunity to have an orderly life.
Mr. Chair Dabney, I think that's a very valuable idea, especially since we don't have any idea when that might be. So you can be assured you will get a notice. Now, the Senate usually has a half-hour notice, but I think we can we'll give a 45-minute notice. There we go. Bipartisan.
Oh, true. True. So we will give a 45-minute notice if we reconvene, and that will be based upon some sort of agreement coming from the legislative leaders and the governor regarding budgets.
Madam Chair?
Chair, Representative Riddle.
Is there any time by which you would not call us back tonight?
Oh, like, can you go to bed tonight? Yeah, we will know by 9. I will not call something past 9 p.m. Okay. A notification at 9, which means we hope there's some swift movement here.
And,
thank
and
you.
Madam Chair, just, I know, you're trying to get out of here, and we're not trying to hold it up. Yeah. I assume if there is no reconvening by 9, we don't need to return to adjourn.
Absolutely. We'll just automatically adjourn. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. All right, so everybody's clear, 45 minutes notice. As soon as we get something, and at 10 o'clock would be the latest we would reconvene. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
Meeting
recess.
Meet. We don't need the tap. Okay.